Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 65 of Underserved. Today, we are featuring Pete Langlois, Director of Information Technology at Acuant. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Pete, thank you very much for joining us on Underserved.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
So, like me, your formative years were spent at the keyboards of Commodores and Apples. How did that start?
Yeah, I started somewhere around fourth, fifth grade, somewhere around there with a Commodore 64 as our first home computer, playing games and downloading stuff with a 300 baud modem back in the day. Big thing, we moved from school. We had Apple IIs and TI 32s and all this other stuff there. And one of the cool things that I found when I got into middle school is they had computers, and that was a big thing for me. And they allowed us to get in there and start messing around with the computers. But the eighth graders thought they were cooler than everybody else. They had a little password file, so you couldn't get on their system without their password, and they wouldn't give it to anybody else. So my first foray into hacking, quote unquote hacking, I did a little buffer overflow. Figured out what their password was, rewrote their code so that if they broke my code, it would relaunch my bash file and effectively lock them out of their own system. That was met swiftly with a visit to the vice principal's office. And I had to give them the password and let them back onto their systems. But that was pretty fun.
Are you into gaming back then too?
Yeah, I mean, that was the big thing. Gaming was new, Atari 2600, Commodore 64, Karateka was like my favorite game on the Commodore 64. We got the Atari 2600 and then River Raid and Pac-Man and all those Asteroids, all those games that were cutting edge at the time, because big time arcade player myself. But then, when you had it at home, it was totally different. It was just mind blowing.
And you saved all those quarters.
Yeah. I started, spending them on carts instead of the Atari.
I remember Karateka for the Apple IIc. I had that on disc, and that was just such a cool game. It was like mind blowing graphics at the time.
Oh, yeah. Then Nintendo comes out a couple years later and blows the market wide open. It was big in Japan first, but, when it hit the US market, it was, all bets off with Super Mario Brothers.
Now, you started a bulletin board system out of your bedroom too, right?
Yeah, I ran that for quite a few years. Subsequently, that's how I got my first IT job. Applied at a local place in Plaistow, New Hampshire called PC Warehouse. And they were like, you don't really have any experience. I'm like, well, I've built all my own home computers from my first 286 all the way up to 486s and took them apart, rebuilt them. The big thing, and I told them, I said, I run my own BBS. And they're like, okay, well, this guy must know something if he's running a bulletin board. And it was pretty popular at the time as well. It was one of the top bulletin boards in Southern New Hampshire.
Now, did you have like a second line at your house, or how are you handling everyone contacting you?
Yeah, we had multiple lines coming in the house. So I had people dial in and on my private line. And then when I was needed to download stuff for the BBS, I'd use the home phone line and make sure everybody doesn't pick up the phone when I'm downloading these big files. Because, back then it was, US Robotics 9600 HST modems, and it just took forever to download stuff.
And there was no resuming a download.
No, not at all.
Mom picks up the phone to call grandma. Here's the modem whistle. It's game over.
Oh, yeah. Ah, what are you doing?
So you're at your first job. Like, what do they have you doing there after you impress them with your BBS abilities?
Yeah, so it's building computers, white box computers was the big rage at the time. Everybody was building white box. So we had our own little white box with our little logo on it. Those little 1x1 inch squares that everybody had on their PCs. We had our stuff. And then we also sold IBMs and Apples and Compacts and all that other stuff that everybody else sold too. The big push was, why buy this really expensive Apple or IBM when you can buy our white box with more stuff and cheaper money? So that was the big thing. We had three different stores. We had one up in Dover, one in Nashua. So I would kind of be floater between the three stores. And then we had a big installation out in at Exeter Hospital too. So I'd always be going out there with new computers and setting up their networks and stuff like that as well.
Now, is this also around the time that you got into Star Wars collectibles?
Yeah, I mean, you know, right after high school, you know, I was big into not just Star Wars, but toys in general. I hooked back up with somebody I went to high school with at Haverhill High, Ross Tracy, and we made a little company. And then we'd go to like toy shows and comic book shows and sell toys, Star Wars figures. You know, Star Wars Power of the Force 2 was out at the time. And then whatever else was hot at the time too, like starting lineup figures, Batman figures, you know, all the cartoon type figures. Didn't really get much into like G.I. Joes and stuff like that. If you were a Joe collector or a Joe dealer, that's really all you did. And then there was like general people, like we had a little bit of everything. We didn't really just kind of focus on one thing.
Now, I think you had a story about how precious some of these figures were treated.
Yeah. My wife constantly reminds me of this one. We were at Toys R Us and it was raining out, and I had the Princess Leia figure, you know, the coveted Princess Leia figure. And Princess Leia had to get into the trunk before she got in the car. And then I was hurrying to get her in the car and I slammed her head when I was closing the door. So that still haunts me to this day.
I'm sure you haven't lived that one down.
Yeah, she'll never let me live that down ever.
So what do you end up doing after that in the industry?
After being in the computer industry for a while, I was like, do I want to do this forever? So I joined Walmart and did a 4-year stint at Walmart. And you know, it was cool and it was different. I was in charge of the electronics department there. So I was still kind of dealing with computers, just whatever we were selling, Compaq or whatever Walmart was selling at the time. So, but then Star Wars came out on VHS, right? The THX edition of Star Wars came out and it was like the hottest thing on the planet. And I built this huge display in the middle of the aisle with, you know, like a futon, and the biggest TV that we were selling at the time, I think it was like 35 inch TVs, you know, those big 200-pound, 35-inch televisions. Set one of those up right in the middle of the aisle with the futon and all kinds of stuff that we'd sell in the store. And then I'd have Star Wars on repeat all day long. So people would be buying Star Wars and Star Wars and Star Wars. They'd, hey, do you have any more Star Wars? And I actually sold out of Star Wars and I had to steal Star Wars VHS tapes from all the other stores because they weren't selling them. And then I was number one in the entire New England region because I had that display. And then management team, they said to all the other store managers, like, why are you selling this stuff? And like all the other stores started to try and copy what I did, but it was kind of too late. I had already had that big rush. They could never catch up after that.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So do you take that experience in how to kind of merchandise things and get people interested and use that in trade shows next?
With trade shows and stuff, you know, when I went to Contour Design after, or not Contour, but
CD-ROMs Plus, right?
Yep. That merchandising thing, you know, after I left Walmart, you know, I kind of wanted to get back into computers because they paid better, right? Purely a money thing at the time. Again, building those white box computers. But this particular place, CD-ROMs in Salem, New Hampshire, they did a lot of stuff on the weekends too, right? We'd drive down to New Jersey with a 20-foot trailer full of computer stuff and sell discs and CD games and cards that you'd put in your computer to build your own PC. And after a few shows, it was really apparent to me that everybody was selling the same crap. Right. It was like race to the bottom. Who can sell the cheapest crap? And I said, this doesn't work. So I went to the company. I said, let's go the other way. You know, we can sell all this other stuff that you want to sell, but let's bring in some high end stuff. Let's bring in like some NVIDIA cards, high end Fire GLs, and some of the more expensive stuff, because nobody has any of the stuff here. All of a sudden, you know, that next show, I had a few of the cards in and they sold out instantly. And then all of a sudden it was like, hey, can you get more of those? So we were selling all these $400, $500, $600 cards back then when nobody else was having them. And we were just raking the money in because we had no competition. And nobody really figured that out for quite a few months before they tried to start selling the same stuff. But we were just ahead of the curve. You know, my wife was helping out at the time too. So she'd be in the software sales and I'd be selling and all the hardware. It was a great time. You know, we'd go out to dinner and stuff and then drive back home on a Sunday night after, you know, 2 days of computer shows and then back to work 7 days a week.
That's got to be a grind though, because 7 turns into 14, turns into 21 and 28. Does that eventually get to you?
It did. kind of a bad timing. I was offered a position from Johnson & Johnson, which is a company in Hempstead, New Hampshire that no longer exists, but they made the layers in between the copper, that copper layer in between the silicon that makes motherboards. And they had a patented solution for that. You know, they offered me a position. I said, oh, totally into this. They want to pay me more money. Follow the money, right? I did that for a little while. What they really wanted me to do wasn't what I wanted to do. They wanted me to more be like a programmer, and I wanted to be more like a network admin. And so we parted ways after a little while, and then looking to do something different. You know, Cooking Audio Video in Salem, New Hampshire, they were looking for somebody. I was already a customer out of the Manchester store, spending crazy money. I'm like, why don't I get this stuff as a discount? I could sell the stuff and then buy this stuff at a discount too. This is the best of both worlds, right? So, you know, all this high-end audio and video gear that I'm buying at full retail, I could buy it at 50, 60% off. So I did that for about a year, selling high-end Snell, B&W, NAD, Macintosh, Adcom, Yamaha, Sony, the whole gamut. We sold everything. Even sold the garbage Bose stuff too. They're the greatest marketing company in the world. They have those little plastic paper cones in all their systems, and people just flock to them. Oh, I got to buy this Bose. So I'm like, I can sell you something that sounds 10 times better for a fraction of the price of this Bose system. Oh no, I want those little teeny cubes. Okay. That was the thing, you know. Unfortunately, at that time, I was there for just about a year, and the funding ran out. Banks decided to not extend us any credit. And I was already talking to another company to move away from selling in retail because, you know, retail is kind of a bummer, right? I mean, you're there all the Saturday, Sunday hours and everything else. And I was trying not to do that after being at CD-ROMs for such a long time too. So the company said, you know, we're closing up shop. We got like 2 or 3 weeks left. And I had already basically given my notice saying, hey, you know, I liked working here and everything, but time for me to go. We had this like kind of fire sale. So I called up all my friends and I said, look, bring in all your stuff. I'll give you credit for what you paid for it. And then I'll sell you stuff at like 60% off. So like all my friends, they brought in all this, all their old stuff they purchased from either me or from somebody else at Cooking from another store or whatever. My buddies were walking out of there with 70-inch high definition television. At the time, that was the super rear screen, big TVs, projection TVs. They weighed 600 pounds and stuff like that. Monster televisions. There was no such thing as flat panels back then. I mean, the flat panels would $20,000 for, you know, a plasma television at the time.
And so from there, you move on to Contour Design, start working with Apple more?
Yeah, so that was the big thing, right? Is my wife was already working at Contour, and she was like employee number 4 there. And they make like ergonomic mice. They made mice in multiple sizes. They were the only company that actually made mice in left hand and right hand, right? So huge market. They made, you know, 8 different sizes of mice for left and right. I think I was employee number 9 or something like that there. And we started growing that business. You know, I was running like the tech support and that kind of stuff. And then Apple comes out with the new iMac, the Bondi Blue iMac. It really changed the way Apple was actually even a company, right? Because they were getting ready to just kind of bomb out. They brought Steve Jobs back in. He comes out with this radical new design. And then we saw that as a great opportunity to, you know, take our mouse technology that we've already been building mice for years and make a mouse with the same Bondi blue color. So we had a mouse that had a right click, which nobody else did, right? And that was a big thing for mice in Apple, right? Because Apple just was a one click thing. They didn't have right clicks or anything like that. And we built that into our software, and we started selling these mice like crazy. Then they came out with the 5 colors. So we were selling it to Circuit City and all the big players that were out there at the time. And it was going great. You know, there was a great opportunity for Contour. The next big thing that they were coming out with was OS X, right? That was the next big thing. Apple had purchased this software called Final Cut Pro from Macromedia. And we said, we'd love to make a device so that you could do like jog shuttling and make your editing easier. And Apple was like, yeah, let's do it. You know, our founder and president of the company, he flew out to Apple. They had meetings and stuff to kind of figure out what Apple would want in a device, created the device. They loved it. We started selling it. Go to the big trade shows like Comdex and Macworld, and you could see our Shuttle Pro device in the Apple booth, vendor section and stuff like that. It was great. We were going crazy. We had vendors calling us to bundle our hardware with their software as well. Whatever software was out there, we were making, you know, special customized templates for them, because that was a big thing, right? Instead of dragging your mouse across the screen, you could just use a shuttle wheel, which, you know, back in the tape days, everybody, that's what everybody used, right? You'd use your little jog shuttle, but nobody had that in the digital world. And we were the first ones to really bring that down into a price point that normal people could afford, right? Because you could buy a DaVinci or whatever for thousands of dollars that had, you know, the jog shuttle, but most people can't afford that. So we came out with a $100 product that was like it. It was it. You know, everybody wanted it.
And that's a catalyst that helps move more Apple product too. Did you get to meet any of the Apple executives?
Yeah, there was one time I was at one of the Macworlds in San Francisco, and I went up to Phil Schiller, and you know, he'd just gotten off stage and said, "Hey, Phil, Pete Langley is from Contour Design." He's like, "I know who you are." I was like, pretty cool, you know, the number two guy at Apple knows who I am. I put a big smile on my face, and I went back to the booth. I'm like, "Hey, I just met Phil Schiller." And he's like, "I know who you are." And everybody's like, "Oh, that's pretty cool."
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first.
You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So from there, though, you end up working with the evil empire, IBM, for a little while?
Yeah, we had a little bit of a split with Contour, took our shuttle division and kind of tried to split it off into its own little section. It didn't work. So after a while, I got laid off and I went to work for IBM Global Services at Pearson Education. They were looking for a Mac person, so I was in charge of all the Mac servers that they had. I was there for quite a few years, kind of got everything automated the way I wanted it. You know, I'd be running, you know, 7 a.m. till 9 or 10 o'clock at night some nights because I had to deal with all the data centers on the East Coast, but then I also had two data centers on the West Coast as well, making, you know, $60,000 to $80,000 a year in overtime, and they didn't care. So I was like, okay, you don't care. I don't care either. The big shift while I was there was moving away from, like, you know, the 42U racks of one server into SAN technology. So that was a big thing. You know, they were looking for somebody to learn the SAN technology because the SAN technology is controlled by the Unix team, not the Windows team. And I was more the Windows Mac guy. And they said, "We'd like you to learn this stuff." And I said, "All right, well, you know, send me to training and I'll learn all this stuff." And they said, "Well, you know, you're a contractor. We can't pay for it." And I said, "Well, if I pay for it, then you're going to have to give me a raise because, you know, I'm learning a skill that you need." And they said, "Okay." So I called up Brocade. I said, "What's the program? How much is it?" And they said, "Well, who do you work for?" I said, "I work for IBM. I have an IBM, you know, email address." They're like, "Oh, yeah, we can give you like 50% off the training." Like, perfect. So instead of costing, you know, whatever it was, $4,000 at the time, cost me $2,000 out of my pocket. Then after I finished the training, I went back to my boss and said, "Look, I finished the training. I can do all this stuff now." So I got like a 45% raise. So instead of them just paying for a $2,000 class, they ended up losing on that deal. But
well, it's always good to bet on yourself.
That's right. You know, learn and then they'll teach because we had data centers all over the U.S. It wasn't just me. When I started, there was 18 counterparts on my team and none of those Windows guys knew anything about SAN either. So I taught all of them how to use the SANs that were being implemented in their location so I wouldn't have to own every SAN in the environment, which was better for me. I was already working enough. I didn't need to work even more when something happened on the SAN.
All good things must come to an end. I imagine someone starts sniffing at the budget there and says, "Hey, we got to change things up."
IBM, whenever they do the contracts, right, they start off strong and they say, "We'll start off at this much and then we'll end up saving you money at the end of the contract by reducing headcount or whatever." So my contracting company calls me up and says, "Hey, you know, look, IBM is taking percentage that we're going to take as well, but we're going to tack on our own additional percentage greater than a 15% of my base salary." They were just going to take that away. And then they said, "Oh, yeah, by the way, we're not going to pay you time and a half for overtime anymore." So I was like, "Well, hold on. So you're saying not only you're taking money away from me just to start my base salary, but you're also going to take all my overtime pay away. I'll get just straight time for this." So that was going to be $60,000 or so a year. And I said, "Yeah, not going to keep working here." So I called them Christmas Day and said, "I quit. I met my IBM boss the day after Christmas, but he was in the same kind of boat too. He was getting moved off the account. He's like, I have the benefit of still having a job. I'm just getting moved off the account. I'll have to go somewhere else, but it is what it is. And I had a great opportunity to move instead of going to Boston. I could be driving from Derry to Manchester, New Hampshire. So I did a stint at Fairpoint. They were doing the big conversion from Verizon because Verizon was divesting themselves of Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, and they needed help. So I joined them, and it was supposed to be a temp to perm type thing. I was there a couple months, and there they kept extending the contract. It was like a one month extension. I'm like, oh, what's going on here? They had spent like $40 million on their data center, and they built it wrong. All their hot air was blasting out the back into the Windows servers and then into the Blade servers. And then all the way at the back is the sand that's just sucking in all this hot air because they didn't have any cold rows. So one day they took all our contractors, all 220 or so of us contractors, and said, your last day is next Thursday. Thanks for everything. That was kind of a blow because I was learning a lot about, you know, VMware and building my skill set, and then, you know, just kind of had the rug pulled out from me. It was about 6 months before I landed over at Century Bank.
What do you end up doing for them?
Same thing, you know, data center. They were putting in a VMware solution and they needed somebody to run that. The person that was running that solution was out on medical leave and they didn't know when he was going to be returning. So kind of slid into there, and it seemed like a great place to work. Family owned bank. It wasn't like I was working for some giant conglomerate or anything like that. I call it a small bank, one of the largest banks in Massachusetts at the time. But I learned everything I wanted to learn, I was able to learn there. You know, we buy new technology, just kind of keep integrating. We'd upgrade all the servers and the SAN and working my way through each cycle, taking on more responsibility, kind of starting my focus on security at the time. That was a big thing when you're going from anywhere into banking. It's totally different, right? It's security first, right? We're protecting customers' money, their identities. It's a little different than Pearson. You know, it's a book. It doesn't have the same impact, right? You know,
it can only hurt people so much with books.
That's right. So then I got my first kind of real manager, who was Adam Glick. He was the first person that really was like a security focused person. And he was like the super whiz kid, right? He came at us and said, we're going to change all this stuff around. And that was a big change for the bank. We were not great with the security stack that we had, but he brought in a bunch of new security tools, kind of secured our focus on that stack that he was building. We always had great audits, and it was a funny story that one of the audits, they really couldn't find anything wrong with us. So they started poking around and stuff in the server room, and they wrote us up for having dust bunnies under the server cabinet.
Said every data center ever.
Yeah, that was their finding. You know, hey, you know, you have dust bunnies under your server cabinets. Okay, thank you. See you next year. Yeah. Right? But it was a great time. I mean, we gelled as a team. We bonded as a team. The bank had season tickets to the Bruins and the Celtics. And it was a couple Bruins games that we went to as the group. Adam, Andy Mallett, who was our desktop tech wizard, you know, do it all. I mean, he was, without Andy, I mean, it was brutal. When he left the company, it was like this huge brain drain when he left, because it's just anytime you need something, it was like, ask Andy. Andy knows. He's been here for like 20 years. He knows everything. But we went to a Bruins game, the three of us, and then I brought my son, and we're sitting right on the glass, you know, section four, right in the shoot twice section, and Luch scores a goal right in front of us, and they have the big celebration, like, right in front of us, and we end up on the back page of the Herald, in the customer seats, right? So these seats are for customers. They're not supposed to be for employees. And everybody gets the Herald delivered to their desk. So the CIO comes over and says, hey, it'd be nice if you guys don't end up on the back page of the Herald ever again.
Century ends up merging with Eastern Bank, right?
Yeah. This past year, you know, we were dealing with COVID and everything else, and, you know, this giant push to get everybody working remotely. You know, we went from having 8 people on VPN to like 170 in a matter of 2 months. And that was the big push in 2020. We get through that whole thing. We're a finely tuned machine. About a year before that, we brought in a new security manager, Jeff Fradbury, which was a totally different mindset than Adam. But again, kind of further moving us along the security path, really took me and kind of mentored me into that management position, because I was always the senior systems engineer person. And he kind of molded me into being a manager. because a position came open at the bank. And, you know, I went to the CIO, Jason Melius. I said, hey, look, I know this position's been open for a while. You're having trouble filling it. I'd love to take a stab at it. He talked to me and said, you told me that you didn't really want to be a manager and we never even talked to you about it. And I said, you know, changed my mind. It was this kind of moment where, do I want to be the tech guy forever or do I want to start expanding and growing as a person? So that kind of moved me into that management position where Jeff helped me along there. We're an in-house exchange shop, right? So trying to get out of that, because anybody that's running exchange still is crazy, right? Just why? So we just wanted to get rid of that burden of patching exchange servers. And that was my big thing for 2021. It was to get us off of there. And I have the quote, and I give the guys at EchoStore a verbal saying, look, I don't have the purchase order yet, but I've already selected you guys. I'm just waiting for this purchase order. And he's like, great, you know, this is going to be awesome. We're going to do this conversion. We're going to make you into Office 365 and exchange in the cloud. And then we all get an email saying that the bank's being purchased by Eastern Bank. So I go up to the boss, the CIO, and I said, hey, you know, what's going on with this exchange project? He's like, yeah, we're not doing that. So 4 months of my time trying to get this all nailed down in this big, massive project. And all of a sudden it gets pulled out for me. And then, you know, we start this merger project, which was from March-ish to November, just to get everything moved over to Eastern Bank. It was a project. I've never been in a merger before. The last time the Century Bank had purchased another bank was before I started. So we kind of were growing organically, one or two branches a year type thing. But this was like a whole on, you know, they were just buying everything, you know. And the management team, you know, myself, Jeff, and Jason, they were trying to work something out. It didn't work out. So we were left with no jobs, but I was lucky enough to get most of my team hired with Eastern Bank. So I thought that was a great thing for me to make sure that my team was secure in their position.
So now you're at Accuint. What are you doing there? What do they do?
Accuint is a totally different type of company. I was looking at, do I want to go to another bank? Because there's tons of positions out there in the security field. And that's where I was kind of heading. So I was talking to a number of different banks in Boston market. And this position at Accuint changed titles, I don't know, 3 or 4 times while I was interviewing. But I told them, I said, I want to do something that's different. And they were just acquired like almost a month before I actually started by GBG in the UK. So there was like this big thing. And I was like, well, you were just acquired. I just finished an acquisition. What's going on with you? And they're like, we're 100%. We're good to go. They're kind of leaving us alone. Our portfolios are enough separate that they don't compete with each other. They're more complementary. So their big focus on is like digital identities and building that trust, preventing fraud and abuse associated with false or synthetic identities. The big thing that they're doing, right, is they're trying to, for example, right, when you go to TSA, right, when you're checking in at the airport, put your credentials down on that little scanner thing. That's their technology. So they create all that hardware and then it goes back and it tells you if that document is a legit document. So if passport is fraudulent, it'll scan it and tell you it's a fake passport. Their whole company is kind of brought about with the attacks on 9/11, right? So really before that, there wasn't that document verification process. I mean, you know, you go a bank account or whatever, you show them your license and there you go, right? There was no verification that it was actually a real license. Anybody could just create a license and here you go. But the tragedy of 9/11 really shifted the focus towards that document verification.
KYC, know your customer, AML, yep. Anti-money laundering, all the three-letter acronyms.
Oh, yeah. Blockchain, you know, all the cool acronyms, you know, we're doing all that kind of stuff. It's a great space. We're growing now with GBG. They're global as well. And so it makes it easier for us to grow with their backing as well, right? So they have a much larger IT team. So we're going to be able to leverage some of their IT team, the sales organization. We're hiring like crazy. I've only been there 2 months, you know, and we're getting ready to move offices. So it's going to be fun. We're going to move in 8 days. So,
all right. Well, we better finish up. I'm sure you have a lot to do. So when you're not at your keyboard, you enjoy photography?
Yeah. I started photography kind of young. You know, I did the school yearbook in eighth grade. I had a Canon AT-1, fully manual, black and white film, and I did that. You know, I had fun taking pictures and capturing moments. And then when I got to high school at Haverhill High, they had an actual photography class where you could actually develop film and stuff like that. So I was like, this is cool. I want to do this. So I took basic art, took the photography class, and really loved developing film and capturing images and moments in time. Freshman year, that was like the beginning. Then sophomore year, they didn't really have like any advanced class. You could take the same class over and over again, and you'd get credit for it every single time. So I was the only one that was taking that photography class as a third time. So, you know, my instructors were like, you know, we need to push you because your assignments are going to be different than the people that only taken this once. So help me look at what I'm taking pictures of and not just snapping pictures, but kind of building a scene. And that kind of transitioned into digital eventually, right? Because there's a time between high school and then when digital technology comes into play, you know, when you're taking pictures of your kids and stuff with the little point and shoot cameras and stuff like that, there's not much you can do, right? The lenses are so small, everything's in focus. You can't really differentiate between the foreground and the background. It's just all one two-dimensional layer. But 9/11 was really the start of the digital photography era. A lot of photographers were forced into digital at that same time.
Why is that?
We were married on 9/9/2001, 2 days before 9/11 happened. And our wedding photographer was also an AP photographer. And she got called on 9/11 saying, you know, you need to be here. And she was shooting film and she's like, I can't shoot this in film because it, you know, she's shooting, you know, giant 3x5 frames of film for weddings and stuff. She's not shooting like 35 millimeter, right? She's shooting like
the full frame stuff.
It was bigger than full frame. You know, the size of the actual negative was 3x5 inches. It's huge. And that was the big thing. She couldn't bring that kind of equipment down there. So she bought like the Canon, whatever was, you know, that first digital camera that came out, and she converted right there. And she was down there for 9/11 aftermath shooting digital. Come to find this out, you know, after the fact. But that was the last time she shot with film was our wedding.
Huh. And then you're also involved in the Londonderry Police Explorers post 11/37. What is that?
Yeah. So my son has always been interested in police and fire, you know, just like every little kid is, right? When they're growing up, they, I want to be a fireman. I want to be a policeman. And then we were at the Londonderry Old Home Day and there was a booth set up with the Londonderry Police Explorers. And we said, you know, what is this all about? The big thing was they're teaching the next generation of law enforcement on how to be law enforcement. You go in twice a month on every other Monday. They teach you all the different skills. It's physical activity. So 1 week they're doing push-ups and all the stuff you do to make yourself fit to be a police officer. And then the next time we do like drill and ceremony type stuff where you're, you know, marching in lines and stuff like that. But it was everything, right? You're doing felony traffic stuff. So we'd have a police car and we'd have a car in front of it. And then we'd pull the people out, make sure that they're following the correct rules for engagement and stuff like that. We'd do use of force. Mike McCutcheon, who is one of the longtime sergeants over at Londonderry Police, he has his own company now. He's also a teacher at a number of universities, and he teaches forensics. He goes around the country all over the place and he teaches forensics, and he came in and taught the class, and he brought in all of his tools and did fingerprinting, and, you know, he set up like a whole crime scene and stuff and used lasers and, you know, smoke and stuff so we could see the lasers. It's really cool. You know, we have these competitions and stuff that we placed second and third with our two teams the last year, which was pretty good because the Nashua was always like sweeping 1, 2, and 3 because they had such a huge post. But then we came in 1 year, we took second place. And then the second year that we were there, we took second and third, I believe.
Nice. So Pete, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks, Andrew. I had a blast. It was really cool to talk to you, and hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
Absolutely. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.